Welcome to Mid-Econ, a podcast that highlights work done by students and faculty in the Economics Department at Middlebury College. I'm Eric Gong, a professor in the department, and I'll be your host for this episode. My guest for this episode is Grace Osberger. Grace is class of 2025 and is perhaps one of the most independent students I've ever encountered at Middlebury College, which is saying quite a lot. As Grace's thesis advisor, I remember having long conversations about possible ideas, and when Grace landed on one which involved running an experiment, I told her, quite frankly, that I did not have as much experience and might not be able to support her well. Grace was undeterred, and she pulled off a remarkable thesis. She anticipates problems, finds solutions, and I would say that probably for the first half of her thesis, I really didn't do much advising. Grace basically figured out many things on her own. I believe that whatever Grace sets her mind onto, it will be accomplished, and given that she cares a lot about the well-being of others, she will undoubtedly make this world a better place. Grace and I sat down to talk about Middlebury, her thesis, her dreams of opening a bookstore, and a lot of other fascinating topics. I hope you enjoy. Grace, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
I'm going to be so fascinated to hear more about your thesis. Now, naturally, I'm your thesis advisor, so I've read a lot of what you've done. But I think what happens when people talk about their research, it kind of brings it to life. And so I'm really excited. But before we begin, I would love to hear more about how you ended up at Middlebury.
Yeah, I actually ended up here kind of by surprise. I was interested in the East Coast, but I never toured Middlebury and applied on a whim because there's no essay. I think you just submit your Common App essay. And then I really wanted to go to Bowdoin, didn't get into Bowdoin, and committed to a different school in Canada, a public university, and then got into Middlebury off the wait list and thought, okay, I guess I'll go here. And so the first time I showed up on the campus was kind of a huge surprise. It was definitely similar to a lot of the campuses I toured, but it was weird getting here for the first time and having no idea what it was going to be like. I do remember when they called me and told me I'd gotten off the wait list and I looked up Middlebury, the first thing I saw was the ski hill. So I was really excited about that. And immediately the next year, I ended up taking a gap year and I bought a snowboard and learned how to snowboard at home. So that was really fun. But it was very exciting to get to do that college, I guess, the process where you're online trying to see what a college is going to be like again, kind of.
So you didn't do any of the, did you do the Middlebury College tour?
No, I toured like Bowdoin, Tufts, the Coast Guard Academy, but we weren't quite as far. I guess we did drive right through Vermont. I honestly have no idea why we didn't stop here. I was a sailor in high school and I wanted to go somewhere with a varsity sailing team, which really restricted the options. But I think coming from the Midwest, I just didn't have as much of an awareness of how the East Coast schools worked, didn't really apply at that many places. So in a lot of ways, I think I got really lucky ending up here and really liking it.
I think we share maybe similar stories of how we ended up at Middlebury. I had no idea what Middlebury was all about until I got my PhD and started applying for jobs. I still didn't know what Middlebury is about until they offered me an interview. And then I looked up, like, oh, this seems like a really neat place.
Yeah, luckily it's so beautiful that you look it up or get here and you think, well, this has to be awesome.
Yeah. Did you end up on the sailing team at Middlebury?
Yeah, I did club sailing for the first 3 years. And then after study abroad, things kind of shifted in my life and I ended up getting more involved in some other clubs and stopped doing it. It's very challenging thing to do as a club sport. We mostly competed against varsity teams. Like Bowdoin has a varsity team, Tufts has a varsity team, but the league just isn't big enough for everyone or for to have separate competitions. So it was a lot of administrative stuff and not the resources that were sometimes needed to run a sailing team.
Right, right. So remind me, I think I have this right. You are an econ and history double major, is that
yes,
correct?
Yes, yes.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, it's definitely been a crunch to get all of the requirements done. But luckily I knew coming in, I pretty much was 100% that was what I was going to do. So I started fulfilling the requirements right away, which was really helpful. I think if you don't get those intro econ credits right off the bat, things can get really stressful.
So you knew before starting Middlebury that you wanted to do econ.
Yeah,
I did. That's surprising. And not all students know that. Why?
I think I can credit it pretty much all to one high school teacher that I had. She taught my U.S. history classes, AP Gov, and an econ class. It wasn't the AP econ class. It was just a one semester elective, but I just loved her and I loved all of her classes. She was so enthusiastic. And she had done an econ master's program, which is pretty rare for a high school teacher. So I think that helped a lot that she really knew what she was talking about teaching that class and was so genuinely interested in it coming from the econ masters. So she got me super excited about US history and economics. I thought a bit about political science, but I guess my mom kind of pushed me to just choose right away too. So I made the choice and was pretty happy with it.
As a teacher, I love hearing these stories about how either a high school or college teacher has such a major impact on someone's trajectory.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny how big. I've met with her since then, and she was pretty excited that I was studying.
Do you feel comfortable giving her a shout out right now?
Yeah, Miss Giovannis. Hopefully I'll have to reach out to her when I get home this summer and go get coffee with her and tell her about this thesis that I did.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I thank you as well, because Grace is just well prepared to be doing a thesis, and we have you to thank for part of that. Well, speaking of theses, what is your senior thesis about? And wait, you know what? I will just read out the title so we
Perfect.
All are on the same page. Let me see. I have it here in my notes. Improving Consumer Decisions in the ACA Marketplace, a Lab-Based Experiment on the Effect of Risk-Tailored Cost Estimates. That is a mouthful.
Yeah,
it sounds
is.
Really fascinating to me because I'm an economist, but perhaps to our audience, they might be thinking, wow, this sounds really, I don't know what to make of this.
Yeah, a lot of words happening there.
Yeah, can you unpack it?
So the Affordable Care Act, ACA Marketplace, I'm studying basically how consumers make decisions within that marketplace. I'm not sure how much the population is generally aware of what the marketplace is, but it's where people who aren't covered by their employers and aren't covered by other government-administered health insurance like Medicare and Medicaid purchase health insurance. So the goal of the platform is to sort of bring together all the available plan options in one place, kind of streamline the shopping process. And then they also administer subsidies to almost everyone who shops on the platform gets subsidies. And they regulate the coverage that's required from insurers and try to protect against predatory pricing, I guess. They're not allowed to change plan prices based on most health characteristics. Can vary a little bit based on age and obviously family size. And I think tobacco usage is the only one that they're allowed to change prices for. But the goal is to make healthcare affordable, essentially. And so I'm studying how do consumers choose these policies and how can we help them choose better policies, because they're not doing very well. Previous research has shown that it's a really confusing shopping process and people tend to make choices that are either bad for their financial outcomes or bad for their health outcomes. That's
what a typical person who's going to be shopping for their own health insurance, it's probably not someone who's hired at a major corporation, right?
No,
it's going to be like a freelance worker.
Yeah. So freelance workers would be a big one. People who work for small businesses. So anyone who either owns a small business or works for a business, I think it's under 50 people is the cutoff for the marketplace. And because I guess I'm I personally wasn't super familiar with how employer-sponsored insurance or Medicare or Medicaid all worked. So that was a real learning curve. So the employers and the government have this large bargaining power with insurers. When you're a small business, that becomes less possible. So that was also one of the goals of the Affordable Care Act, was to be able to administer health insurance to those people, and rather than having small businesses have to pay way more and encourage those businesses to stay open, I guess. And, but
so is this, this sounds like a complicated process. I know we're doing this, you know, as a podcast, but I would probably encourage people to take a look at your thesis and maybe see some images of what consumers are facing when they go on these exchanges and they have to like figure out what's the best health insurance plan for me.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot of different moving parts in these attributes. I guess I usually say they vary over a lot of attributes, and there's a lot of plans varying over a lot of attributes, and they're varying over every year. So it's not like you can find a health insurance policy that works and then stick with it for 10 years, because you're going to go back and that one's not going to be there. And they're kind of complicated. I mean, when I started this project, I didn't even know what the difference between a deductible and an out-of-pocket maximum was. And I think a lot of Americans are kind of in a similar place. I mean, maybe you have some idea, but the way that people value these things is not as rational as it might be in a much simpler marketplace scenario where, you know, you go to the grocery store and things just have prices. These things have a lot of different moving parts. You have a monthly premium of essentially a price, but then all these other varying things that nobody knows how they work.
I think maybe I'm going to try an analogy on the fly. So excuse me if it doesn't quite work, but it would be like as if I went to a grocery store and looked at a box of cereal and it gave me the price, but it also gave me the price if I were sick that day, it would be a different price.
Right.
And if I were like depressed, it would give me another price. Like, are you depressed today? Well, your box of cereal actually costs this much.
Right.
And it would taste differently too, depending how I felt. Is that kind of like a rough analogy?
Yeah, and then really maybe like if you didn't like it to a certain degree, there's an opportunity for a rebate in the future. Uh-huh. So it's so many moving parts, things, I mean, and so many behavioral economic kind of concepts that affect that. So we talk about like present bias, people value those monthly premiums differently than they value the deductible, when in reality, those are both dollar amounts that you're probably going to end up paying. So they should probably be valued the same. And then also just the cognitive overload is a really big part of this. You are choosing between up to 100 plans sometimes. And so not only do you not understand what's happening with the plans, but you're trying to compare them over 100 different policies. You've got maybe 6 or 7 different insurance providers. You don't really know which one you want. You kind of want to stay with the same one.
All right. I'm waving the white flag right now. Yeah, I'm just like, oh my goodness, this is too much. So instead of, I mean, I think ideally, Grace, you would just tell me what policy to get.
Right.
But you have a novel idea that you implement it in an experiment. Could you tell us more about this idea?
Yeah, yeah. So I started thinking about the marketplace, and I started thinking, how can we, it's called choice architecture in the literature, how can we put in these additional tools or sort things differently to help people make better choices without removing the decision-making process? Because we want people to have choices of how they choose health insurance based on, you know, their financial situation or their health situation. And I came across on the Vermont platform. So states can either use the federal platform or their state one. Vermont uses a state one. And it's health insurance in Vermont is really uniquely highly regulated quite well. And they have this tool that is a cost estimator. There's cost estimators available on the federal website, but they're a little bit convoluted. In Vermont, it automatically displays 3 different cost estimates. This is what I'm calling in the title, the risk-tailored cost estimates. And so there's a good year estimate, a balanced year estimate, and a bad year estimate. So like a healthy year versus an unhealthy year. And I think just from going onto that Vermont marketplace and looking at the plans compared with looking at it on healthcare.gov, it becomes really immediately clear how those different attributes, like the deductible and the out-of-pocket limit, are interacting with each other and how that changes based on your health outcomes, which is not blatantly obvious from just one cost estimate. When you see the three cost estimates next to each other, you can immediately identify which plan is higher risk and which plan is lower risk. People who are healthier should be going into those higher risk plans because they are unlikely to get large medical costs. People who are less healthy should be sorting into the lower risk plans. Or, I mean, you can also think about kind of psychological constraints too. People who are going to be really stressed out if they know that there's a potential for having a $5,000 medical bill out of nowhere, maybe they want to choose that lower risk plan. But it really just clarifies, without a bunch of confusing words that people might not want to read, how the attributes work. So I think that's something unique about it. So then I took that tool.
Yeah. So just so I'm following then, instead of looking at like each policy and looking at the deductible, the out of pocket, the all these different attributes, I can really just hone in on this cost calculator that shows me on an average year what's going to be like. If it's a really bad year, let's say I get really sick, I have to be hospitalized, it will show me kind of the estimated cost for that year. But if I'm like of really good health, I don't go to the doctor throughout the year, it's going to give me that kind of a good year estimate.
Right.
And then I can use those two, I can use this calculator to quickly compare different policies.
Yeah. And I think one thing that's really helpful about the bad year estimate in particular is it's essentially telling you what is the maximum that you could have to spend on this plan. Whereas just one cost estimate, it's going to be an average, not a maximum. And I think it makes people feel a lot better to know what is the worst case scenario.
Yeah. And this worst case scenario is going to be different than, say, this out-of-pocket maximum that we frequently like hear about. Is that right?
Right. I think so. The worst case scenario is typically going to be the premium plus the out-of-pocket maximum. Then the bad year, by comparing that bad year to the good year, the difference between those two things indicate kind of the relative coverage level that you're going to get. So if there's a huge difference between the good and the bad year, that would be a really risky plan. So maybe it's cheap, but you're going to be paying a lot more between before you hit that out of pocket.
Yeah, that's a really helpful way of thinking about it. Thanks for clarifying that. And just to reemphasize to our listeners, a bad year is like a bad health year, and a good year is like a good health year.
So you're going to the doctor a lot, or maybe you break your arm and you get a huge medical expense from
that. And there's the possibility to customize these, right? Like if I can give some basic demographics, if I smoke, if I drink, my age, maybe like blood pressure and other characteristics, it can sort of recalibrate these calculations.
Exactly.
Oh, that's fascinating. Okay. So it sounds like then you did this experiment where you've got a group that doesn't get the benefit of this calculator.
Right.
And you get another group, the treatment group, that gets the calculator.
Right. Yeah. So I basically tried to simulate the choice environment as closely as I could on an online survey. And I sent it out in two different rounds. So I sent out the initial survey. Everybody saw the same policies. There were 13 policies, which is actually quite a bit less than you would typically see. But I didn't want the experiment to get too convoluted. And I wanted people to actually be able, you know, they're not actually choosing a health insurance policy. That is one of the flaws of doing research like this. So you do have to make it realistic so that they're not just going to randomly click on something. Because I think if you presented people with 100 plans, they would think, I am not scrolling through these and thinking about it. So there's 13 policies. In the first round, everyone, no one sees that risk calculator. And they choose a policy based on their own health expectations. And then a week later, I come back and split those people into split the participants from round one into two groups, send the survey again. One group sees the exact same thing as the first round, no cost estimates. And the second group does see the addition of the cost estimates. And then I take all of that data and kind of compare, were people switching between rounds? Did the cost calculator make them more likely to switch from their round one policy to in round two? and what were the specific attributes, like what were the prices on those policies?
I see. So you're going to be able to say like, hey, in round one, I get to choose one of these policies. And then for the people in the treatment group, they're going to, in round two, they get the benefit of this calculator. And you're going to see, are those people switching policies to perhaps better policies
right.
versus a control group where they have to choose a plan in round one. And then in round two, it's kind of the same thing. They don't get the calculator.
Right, right. So the assumption was that people, it's kind of a trade-off between that 1 week time limit. I wanted people to not just immediately remember, oh yeah, I picked, you know, the plan that had the $200 per month premium. I'm going to pick the same one again. And I think that worked based on my results, but they also sort of indicated that most people didn't choose the same policy again anyways, which was an interesting result. I think especially given that there's only 13 policies, it's surprising that people didn't identify the same one the second time. But I think that speaks to the confusingness of the plans.
Yeah, this is a complicated decision process. Well, what was the main result?
Yeah, so in the treatment group who saw the cost calculator, they were 9% more likely to switch than the control group. However, the control group was, I think, 52% of those in the control group switched anyway. So about half of them were switching. And then the 9% increase, I think, is a pretty good level. That's comparable to, there's a lot of studies similar to this that test other types of reform. There's educational tools that you can use, nudges where you're just like recommending a plan for someone right off the bat that is best for them based on their expectations. And a 10% difference based on a reform is a pretty solid level. Beyond that, the actual prices of the plans changed in the treatment group too. So those who saw the calculator were more likely to choose more expensive plans in the second round. That's a really interesting result. I think the premium was about $40 higher in the treatment group, which in my opinion, I think it indicates that when you see the cost estimates, they make you more sensitive to the financial risk, which kind of suggests that people, when they don't understand how the attributes work, they think that the plan is less risky. Once they see the cost calculators, now they think they kind of understand those risk trade-offs and are more sensitive to the financial risk.
And this ties back to our discussion a few minutes ago, right? They're able to see the worst, like if my health is really bad 1 year versus really good, you can compare the difference in the cost. And that's, it seems like that's what you're really focusing on.
Right, right. And I think, you know, it's hard to say based on my results. You can't say this is universally a good thing, but there are pretty significant problems of medical debt in America, and especially among this relatively low income, kind of financially volatile group. These massive medical costs can be really crippling. So avoiding those things is probably a good thing. And the risk calculator is seeing that bad year estimate, maybe whether it's like $13,000 in the bad year, people realize, oh, I should not pick this plan because there is a chance, there always is a chance that you're going to have a really big medical bill. I'm sure most people are familiar with that. You go to the hospital for just a small thing and that bill is usually going to be a lot more than you thought it was. So I would say that this is a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. And I think from what I understand, it's probably not too costly to put this calculator, make it available.
No, yeah, I think that's one of the really appealing things about the calculator. I mean, Vermont has already created it. Somebody had to do all of the coding that went into creating these cost estimates based on people's personal health expectations. So it's already done. We can do experiments on it and it's not super invasive. So not only is it not that expensive to implement, but it's not as politically contentious as something like recommending a smart default, because the argument there is that once you take away too much of the consumer choice, then that is going to sort of restrict the supply side and premiums are going to go up and insurers aren't going to be able to properly compete with each other. So I think the cost estimates and any sort of cost calculator or kind of a positive addition to the choice process rather than kind of taking things away. People often propose just lowering the number of plans available, but that just gets a lot of pushback from insurers and economists as well.
Yeah. Wow. This is a fascinating project. Do you have any, do you have any interest in future work with health insurance or, you know, decision making?
Yeah, I think I really, really enjoyed building the experiment. That was my favorite part. I'm not big on the data stuff, the analysis. It was definitely, I learned a lot through doing that. But by far, kind of thinking through what do I need to ask people to get a result that's going to work. And even, you know, it comes down to the wording of every single question, because these, again, they're not choosing real health insurance policies. So you have to be really careful of how to word things, how to order things, so that you're getting the most realistic result possible. And I had a really great time doing that. So, I mean, I don't really see myself going into public policy at this moment. I think... people are usually surprised when I say that I'm an econ major and I have not that much interest in going into econ further, but I do really enjoy just kind of the problem solving that happens. And it's a very active thing that's actually really fun. So I think that's surprising for people. Some people have fun with the coding, but I do not.
Well, I'll speak on behalf of the department. We are very lucky that you decided to become an econ major, and it's been great having you as a student. For any, like, say, second or third year students who might be thinking or considering a thesis, do you have any advice for them?
Yeah, I think I thought about this a little bit in advance. And my biggest advice would be to find something within the field that is genuinely interesting to you. I think people can sometimes have a little bit of a doomist, like a doom and gloom perspective about econ, and don't take the time to like look through the course catalog and see what classes might be really interesting. I personally loved game theory, which is super related to this, and I really liked econ history too. And in these classes, also the causal inference class, I didn't take that one, but those classes where you're going to be reading papers are really helpful in understanding how economists do research and finding something that is interesting to you. There's such a broad field that there's got to be something. And
it's very broad.
Yeah. So, I mean, you see the econ theses. I think people often ask me, they're like, what is an econ thesis? Because it seems like you can do anything, and you really can. There's always some sort of kind of optimization involved or some relationship, but within anything political, history, all of these things have numbers involved, and there are always causal relationships with things. And I would just be surprised if someone couldn't find something that's interesting to them. So yeah, I think find something that you like and look for papers about that. And that was how I kind of got inspired. And yeah, I think there are great classes in the econ department. So stay excited about it.
Yeah. And you're people who are interested can check out my website. And I actually publish all the econ theses that I've advised over the past few years. So definitely check that out. Okay, Grace, we're down to our last four questions I like to ask all of our guests. The first one is, what is your favorite thing about Middlebury?
Yeah, I remember you asked this question to us right at the beginning of the semester too. We have a Slack group chat for the class and everyone responded what their favorite thing about Middlebury was. And I think I said my favorite thing was kind of the proximity to everything on campus and in town. I really enjoy walking and biking around, especially in the spring when the weather is getting nice again. I love walking to the co-op. I usually walk to the co-op on Thursday afternoons. That's one of my big routines. But additionally now, I think one of my favorite, perhaps my favorite thing about Middlebury has been the classes and the relationships that I've been able to form with professors. I have just taken so many truly inspiring classes that I've learned so much in, so many great lecturers that I've had who just go up there and stand at the front of the class, no slides even, and just talk about, I mean, this is history classes in particular, but they just talk about, you know, British, who the British prime minister was at this exact moment for 50 minutes. And it's so enticing. And I think also the discussion sections, I've had some really, really well-managed discussion sections where I have learned so much about not only the topic that's being talked about, but also, you know, how to eloquently... that's ironic that I stumbled there, but how to have positive conversations that are intelligent and useful to everyone in the class. So yeah, it's really unique to go to a small school like this with such a great faculty body.
You should be a Middlebury College tour guide. That was a wonderful pitch. Okay. What would you tell your 16-year-old self?
I think this is kind of similar to what I would tell the second and third year econ students thinking about a thesis. I think when just always have something to be excited about and pursue that thing. I think there's so much stress about, you know, jobs and grades at Middlebury all the time. And that becomes so much easier when you are truly motivated to do something rather than sort of just clicking around trying to find something to complete an assignment or find a job to apply to when you have a real excitement about something, opportunities and ideas come a lot more easily. So yeah, I would say always, I mean, don't abandon things because they're not going well at the moment, but at a certain point when something becomes something that's not bringing you, you know, happiness to do anymore, find something else that does.
Yeah. Okay. Second to last one. Where do you hope to be in 10 years?
I think my most ideal situation, I would love to own a bookstore. I hope to move back to the Midwest. I've thought about becoming a teacher too. I don't have any strong commitments right now, but I think my biggest dream, I think I would really love, I think it goes back to that kind of problem solving and very active stuff. I think it'd be really fun to own a small business, in particular a bookstore.
Do you have a favorite bookstore? Have you ever been to Strand in New York City?
No, I haven't. Oh, I haven't. I recently, I was in Oxford over break and I got to go to Blackwell's, which has the biggest book room in the world. I think that was very exciting, but I really like used bookstores too. And I just think it's so fun when you go into like a small independent bookstore and you can really tell a lot about the owner based on what books are in there. I have this idol, his name is Tom Hodgkinson. He's kind of a amateur anarchist philosopher, and he's a British guy. He owns a bookstore and runs a magazine in in England, and I think the bookstore was also a pub, so it's kind of like a gathering space for the community. People meet. I mean,
that's
like
a great idea. Yeah. I think you should have a bookstore with a pub and like a bakery cafe.
Right, right.
And my daughter will be your baker. She's looking for a place to bake.
A bakery.
Yes.
Yeah. I think just a place where people, all of these things are kind of, all my answers are kind of coming together. I love sitting and talking about books. So having like a book club would be really fun. But yeah, curating a bookstore, I think would be my biggest dream.
Can I put you on the spot? Do you have like any books that come to mind that people should be reading or that you have found like, oh, that was like a great book?
Yeah. So the guy I mentioned, Tom Hodgkinson, he has a book, his magazine is called The Idler, but he has a book called How to Be Free. And it's basically a manual for freedom, in his opinion. And he talks about playing music and having potlucks. And he's definitely a relatively radical thinker. So I can't recommend the book to everyone, but I think I've given it to a lot of people that I know. Mm. And people pretty consistently say it changes their lives and the way that they think about the way they spend their time every day and kind of their relationship to the greater world. So yeah, I would recommend How to Be Free by Tom Hodgkinson. My other favorite book is All the King's Men by Robert Penwar.
No way. Yeah. That is one of my top three.
Really?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. There's a really amazing description in the middle of it that talks about original sin. And I think it compares it to like a spider web. The sins of our ancestors kind of just spread, right?
Yeah.
And it was just a really amazing depiction, I think, of sin.
Yeah. I love the conversation about the great sleep in that book. Mm-hmm. And he also wrote a history thesis. So it's always fun to read that. Yeah. He talks about after he completed, I think he actually didn't complete the thesis. He gives up and he goes into what he calls the great sleep, where he kind of just lays in bed all day. But Robert Penwar is such a great writer. We read that book in high school and it was very daunting. It's a lot of wordy descriptions and things, but I like books like that too, where you just get, at first it's a little painful and then you just get so sucked into the story. Combines all my favorite things: history, American politics.
I'm gonna have to invite you back where we just talk about books.
Right. Well, I'll have to invite you to my bookstore.
All right, so here's the last question. Some people find it a difficult one, some people find it easy. We'll see. What is the meaning or purpose of life?
I think I find this a difficult question to put into words. I would say for me, it would be just building individual relationships with people around you and also, you know, places where you live. I believe that it's really important to live somewhere where you want to participate in the community, you want to help maintain the community. And I think that's one of the things I love about going to a small school like Middlebury. Everything is so interconnected. I'm kind of an introverted person, so it's kind of it's nice to live somewhere where that community is a little bit forced. And I think that's the ideal setup for life. I think that everyone should be reliant on their immediate community, whether that is your school or a town or your neighborhood or your apartment building. And yeah.
It sounds like proximity really matters.
Yeah.
And I think I'll connect what you just said to sort of a battle right now in our culture, right, of the digital world, virtual reality and phones kind of sucking us away from being present in our current space.
Yeah.
All right. Oh my goodness. I'm going to have to invite you for multiple episodes. There's so much to talk about. Grace, thanks so much. This was a wonderful conversation. I've learned a lot and you just have some really insightful thoughts.
Yeah. Thank you so much for all of your extremely insightful feedback and just very consistent support throughout the semester. It's been such an exciting process to go through, and I am so happy that you were my advisor for this.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to MidEcon. Please consider sharing this episode with family or friends who might have an interest in economics at Middlebury. And if you have a moment, please leave a review. Finally, if you have any questions, feel free to email me at egong@middlebury.edu. Subject line, MidEcon Podcast. Until next time, please stay curious about the world and kind to others around you.